Okay, so I'll make a start. As most of you know, the structure of the seminars that we've been following is loosely based on Plato's Allegory of the Cave. So we've been looking at the good, the beautiful, and the true. And this week, I'm going to be looking at the true. It was interesting talking to Tom in the break, so sort of thinking about truth. And he mentioned, the issue from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where they have this whole sort of exploration and journey through the universe, and they come to the answer 42 as the answer to the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. And it would be fantastic if it was that simple, really, wouldn't it? No, it wouldn't, actually. No, it'd be terrible. Good point, yeah. So, yeah. So fortunately, it's not that simple, as Sivadramati says. But, I mean, the core question I want to look at is, what is truth? So what is true? What is ultimately true? And there's lots of answers to that question, of course. In particular, I'm going to look at two philosophical answers to that question. On one side, you've got the world of mathematics, logic, and reason, if you like. And on the other side, philosophically speaking, you've got the truths of science and empiricism. So I'm going to be talking about those two approaches to truth, which are very traditional in the Western philosophical tradition. And I'm obviously going to be talking about a Dharmic perspective on those approaches to truth. So yeah, to start with rationalism as it's known. Rationalism, as I say, is the world of mathematics and deductive logic. I think the world of rationalism in modern Western philosophy starts with Descartes. Siddharshini mentioned Descartes a couple of weeks ago. Descartes really came from a very strong mathematical background. And what he was looking to do, really, was to try and ground knowledge on the same sort of basis as mathematics and logic. So he took mathematics, just very, very basic logic of mathematics, to be true, you know, in all possible worlds. A very, very strong foundation of truth there. I mean, criticise the basis of mathematics? You know, 1 + 1 must equal 2. So that was the Cartesian project, if you like, the project of Descartes at the start of the analytical tradition, really, in philosophy, that he wanted to base knowledge and truth on the same level, the same strong foundations that he took mathematics to have. So that's rationalism, very, very briefly. And then there's a whole school of Western philosophy which is called empiricism. And again, we've heard something about this over the weeks of the seminars. Empiricism is associated with lots of philosophers, particularly with Hume and Locke. Empiricism is particularly associated with the scientific method. I mean, logic actually is as well, but empiricism very strongly so. So one way of talking about empiricism is that every idea must either originate directly in sense experience or be compounded of ideas thus originating. So in more straightforward language, empiricists rely on the world of the senses, the world of facts in the world, and that's their ultimate basis of truth. So observation of the world around us as providing the foundation of truth. So there's a very interesting conversation that happens between philosophers, rationalist philosophers and empiricist philosophers. There's an argument that goes back many hundreds of years about where ultimate truth lies. With people like Descartes, they say, well, you know, obviously mathematics and logic are a much stronger foundation than the world around us, the world of our senses. You know, the truths of mathematics are true in every possible world that we can think of. They can't possibly be wrong. And then empiricists saying, well, all we really have are our senses and how we, you know, how the world around us impinges on our minds. So that's the foundation of truth. So yeah, that's you know, a very very brief sketch of those two philosophical views. And what I want to show is actually, well, when we take these views out of context, when we, you know, these are very, very strong views in our society still. They're not just abstract philosophical views. They really do inform how we go through the world. And they are, when they're taken out of contrast, taken out of context, a big threat to ourselves and to our society, actually. So it's like these views have actually spilled out into areas where they're not so applicable and have caused chaos, in a way. So this is how I'm setting up the seminar. I want to try and explain in the next 37 minutes or so why I think that. Try and look at those two views in the context of the Dharma and sort of talk about the effect they have on us as individuals and society. So I better move on. I'm going to talk particularly about three papers, if you like, and three references. I'm going to talk about, there's a philosopher called Quine, Willard Van Orman Quine, who I think is a wonderful philosopher. And he wrote a paper called Two Dogmas of Empiricism, which is from 1951. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I'm also going to talk about Karl Popper's philosophy, particularly philosophy of science, and his paper Conjectures and Refutations from 1963. I'm going to talk about Edward Conze's Buddhist Thought in India, which is from 1962. So I'm hoping I'm going to get through all of this. So to start with, just a little bit of background to Karl Popper and Quine. So Popper and Quine, these two philosophers that I particularly want to talk about. Their philosophy really is a response to a group of thinkers from Vienna. So there's a group of thinkers in Vienna associated with the University of Vienna, and they're called the Vienna Circle. And they were around up to the start of the First World War. They used to meet in coffee houses and around the University of Vienna. And they were very, very influenced by scientific thinking. And their whole project really was to try and establish philosophy on the same grounds as science, because they took science to be, a way to get to ultimate truth, like to get to reality. And this circle of philosophers had a huge impact on philosophy in, on analytic philosophy in the States and here. They were dispersed really with the rise of the Nazi Party, and you know, most of them settled in the US and the UK and had a huge effect on philosophy here. In a way, we're still engaging with some of the problems they raised. And as I say, their manifesto, if you like, they published a manifesto in 1929, and as I say, they had a scientific conception of the world, as though science could provide truth. So the two features of their worldview were, they're empiricist. They held that there was only knowledge from experience, so experience of the world around us, sense experience. And their approach was marked by a particular methodology, which was logical analysis. So you can see, you know, the two strands of philosophy that I've talked about, rationalism and empiricism, really coming together in their manifesto. So yeah, logical analysis. What they wanted to do was try and reduce experience of the world to statements which were either meaningful or not meaningful. So you can see, you know, direct parallels with the world of science, where so you have Newton's laws of motion, for example, Newton's second law, force equals mass times acceleration. That's a statement that reflects an experience of the world around us, you know, in that case, an experience of motion. So these philosophers are trying to do that to everything, actually, all experience. They're trying to say, well, experience is based on the senses of what we can sense, and it should be analysable logically. And what they said really was, if you couldn't reduce a statement to experience and logical analysis, then basically it was completely meaningless. So if you could reduce a statement to logical analysis, then it was meaningful, and if you couldn't, it was meaningless. So at a stroke, they really sort of jettisoned all metaphysics and speculative philosophy. They just tried to sort of really narrow something down into science, and, you know, our approach to the world, you know, very, very rigorous scientific approach to the world. So that's the Vienna Circle. And there was some very interesting science happening around this time, of course. So as I say, the Vienna Circle were around really up until 1918. And around the same time you had Einstein performing these incredibly groundbreaking scientific experiments, or I should say, you know, coming up with his general theory of relativity. Well, you know, that was really influencing the thought of these philosophers as well. In 1919, there was an experiment on which basically proved Einstein's general theory of relativity. I found it really interesting reading about this. So it's an experiment that Arthur Eddington, who is a researcher, did on the 29th of May 1919. It was the day of a solar eclipse, and those were the conditions that were needed basically to test this particular theory of Einstein's. And the theory basically said that that light is affected by mass. I'm not a sort of a specialist on Einstein. I hope some of you have experienced Jan of Archer's talks on relativity and quantum theory. But basically, the importance of the eclipse was to be able to observe the light from stars close to the sun. And what Einstein's theory said was that light should move slightly away from the sun. If his theory was true, he would predict the amount of distance those stars, the light from those stars, would move from the sun. And basically he was saying light is curved by gravity, this very, very counterintuitive theory of, you know, Einstein's. I almost said Jan of Archer. Jan of Archer's good as well. But yeah, this very counterintuitive theory of Einstein's, that that light somehow is curved by gravity. So this experiment basically set up the conditions to test whether that was true, and it was confirmed by those experiments. And the Vienna Circle of philosophers really took that as further proof of their theory and of their reliance on science as providing truth. And they took it as confirmation of that. That the theory was confirmed. But, you know, very interesting, I think. And so Karl Popper was around at the same time, and what he said was actually that experiment didn't confirm Einstein's theory, and he said a lot more than that. He said that no scientific theory can be confirmed. What he said actually was that what he was interested in actually was trying to demarcate science from everything else. So again, around this time in Vienna, in the build-up to the First World War, it was a time of great turmoil politically, but also there are lots of interesting theories around at this time. You know, you had Einstein's scientific theories, but you also had Freud in lots of interesting psychoanalytical theories as well. And basically what Popper was trying to do was trying to say, well, this is science and this is not science. You also had Marxism and, you know, very strong theories around Marxism. And Popper's whole project was saying, well, the scientific method is different. And he was trying to say how it was different. And what he was saying was, the theories of psychoanalysis, the theories of Marxism, the theories of science are equally confirmable, if you like. So for a Marxist, say, they might see confirmation of their theory in society. They might see confirmation everywhere, because if that's their lens they're seeing things through. What he said about science, what Popper said about science, was actually the rigour of science comes from it being falsifiable. So this experiment of Einstein's was scientific because it was such a risk. He held it up, his theory was held up to be falsifiable. Again, there's a lot I could say about Popper, really interesting philosopher, very interesting in terms of philosophy of science, philosophy of politics as well. But this is what he's best known for in terms of philosophy of science, the idea of science as being falsifiable. But basically what he was saying was you need an infinite number of observations to confirm a theory. You know, with science, you'd need an infinite number of observations to say this is confirmed, because you only need one observation that is different for something to be falsified, if you like. So the logical argument from Popper is that, yeah, you would need an infinite number of observations, say, of Einstein's theory, to be absolutely sure that it's true. So, which is logically impossible. So what his language was much more in terms of scientific theories being corroborated. So you build up a lots of evidence to say there's a lot of corroboration for this scientific theory, but you can never say really that it's true. That's a controversial position. Maybe we'll we can have questions about that as well and discuss that. Yeah. So that's Popper's view, very, very briefly. So I want to move on to Quine. So this philosopher, Willard Van Orman Quine, he's an American philosopher who was writing around the same time as Popper. So Quine had an even more, he did an even more systematic demolition job on the Vienna Circle and the idea of science as providing ultimate truth. His paper, Two Dogmas of Empiricism, is one of the most important papers of 20th century analytic philosophy. And some philosophers call it the most important paper of the 20th century in terms of analytic philosophy. I'd love to be able to say a lot more about this paper. There's just so much in this paper. Maybe I'll just highlight the two dogmas that he was mainly focusing on in the paper very briefly. The first dogma he talked about was the dogma is an unchallenged view, like an assumption that doesn't get challenged. So these two dogmas of empiricism, the first one is that there's a fundamental cleavage between synthetic and analytic truths. So just to explain synthetic and analytic. Basically, synthetic is another way of talking about the world of the senses, the world of facts in the world around us. This distinction between synthetic and analytic is a distinction that Kant made, and it's very similar to, as I say, the difference I've been talking about between empiricism, the idea that we get knowledge from the world around us through our senses, and the idea that we get ultimate truth from logic. and analytic truth. So synthetic is equivalent to sense data and empiricism, and analytic is equivalent to logic in the world of mathematics. So it's just sort of different language. And basically, Quine was saying, actually, there's not a fundamental difference between those two worlds. You know, so he's saying the world of logic and the world of our senses are not as separate as we think they are, and particularly not as separate as a lot of philosophers have said they are over the decades. So that was the first dogma that he went into in a lot of detail, with devastating effect, I think. And the second dogma was what he called reductionism. So this is the belief that every meaningful statement is equivalent to some logical construct upon terms which refer to immediate experience. Long-winded way of saying, again, that you can reduce everything to logical laws based on sense data. So basically, yeah, he did a really fantastic, I think, fantastic demolition job of those two dogmas. And I think the effects of this paper are still being felt in the world of philosophy. And, I mean, he talked about empiricism without dogmas. And I think, for me, studying philosophy, reading this paper was the first time I sort of breathed a sigh of relief, and I felt like I was getting to something of truth. And the reason I felt that, I think, was because I think there's something of the Dharma in what he says and in what Quine says in this paper. I think particularly something of the idea of conditionality that he gets, he moves towards. So I just want to give you a couple of quotes directly from this paper, Two Dogmas of Empiricism. So this is from his section on empiricism without the dogmas. He says that the totality of our so-called knowledge or beliefs, from the most casual matters of geography and history to the profoundest laws of atomic physics, or even of pure mathematics and logic, is a man-made fabric which impinges on experience only along the edges. Or to change the figure, total science is like a field of force whose boundary conditions are experience. So really he's like talking about a web of experience. You know, with logic, logical laws are in that web. Our sense experience is in that web. And he says that's, you know, science and experience generally is much more like that. I'll give you another quote. He says that any statement can be held true, come what may, if we make drastic enough adjustments elsewhere in the system. Even a statement very close to the periphery can be held true in the face of recalcitrant experience by pleading hallucination or by amending certain statements of the kind called logical laws. Conversely, by the same token, no statement is immune to revision. Revision even of the logical law of the excluded middle has been proposed as a means of simplifying quantum mechanics. So basically, what he's doing, and it says right at the start of this paper, he really blurs the line, the supposed boundary between speculative metaphysics and natural science. He's really sort of challenging this idea that science can provide ultimate truth, which is a very, very strong idea, I think, still in our society. And his approach is very, very pragmatic. Very pragmatic. Okay. So I want to... we'll move on, but I just want to sort of just try and sum up a little bit of where we've got to so far. Just say a little bit more about Quine. I mean, I think he's very, very radical. What he's actually saying is all of our beliefs actually are in principle subject to revision. Even the laws of logic, he's saying, are potentially subject to revision. I find it quite interesting. I've talked about this experiment that proved Einstein's theory, or corroborated Einstein's theory of general relativity. So you could say that's science at a very, very big scale. So it's a science of the universe, you know, planetary motion, etc. And Popper was saying, well, actually, you can't have truth. You can't ever prove a scientific theory. Even, you know, you'd need an infinite number of observations to do that. So in a way, that's one end of the spectrum, these, you know, interplanetary scientific theories. And with Quine, he's talking about quantum mechanics and logic. So it's really the other end of the scale, you know, the subatomic level, where some very, very weird things happen. He's saying, actually, you know, you need to think about revising the laws of logic when you get to that, you know, subatomic level. The laws of logic don't really work there. So then, yeah, we have this scientific worldview where you look at those two ends of the spectrum and you think, well, actually, how can it give us ultimate truth if, you know, if that's true, that we need an infinite number of observations to get to truth, and even the laws of logic potentially are subject to revision, then, so, you know, where is our firm foundation for truth? Okay. And I think this, just very briefly, I think ways that these ideas of truth impact on us as a society. I think, like, one area, if you think about economics, you know, with economics, for about 30 years, we've had the idea that the market will take care of us ethically. So it's almost like an idea of logic, the logic of the market, the logic of mathematics, almost. Almost, if you leave it to run of itself, it will provide for the most you know, impoverished people in the society. That's a very strong view, I think. You know, there's a view of the invisible hand of economics from Adam Smith, which I think plays into some of these ideas of logic, and as though, you know, ultimate value can come from pure mathematics or something. And also, I think, you know, if you look at the morality of science as well, you know, science has given us a huge amount, you know, all of the advances of medical science and technology. So I'm not sort of dismissing all of that. Of course, you know, it's really helped us in many, many practical ways, as has economics and, you know, the theories of logic, of course. But also, you know, they did, you know, science has had a very, very strong effects, strong negative effects as well. You know, if we look at climate change and the effects of the technology that we've had, that's had, you know, had on the world, or you know, the science of nuclear weapons, or you know, nuclear power. Again, you know, it's like what I'm trying to say is, can science really provide meaning in our lives and truth, ultimate truth in our lives, when it can bring in these things in its wake? So I'm sort of galloping through. I want to come on to this book from, I think it's 1962, Edward Conser's Buddhist Thought in India. I think it's a little bit dated as a take on the Dharma, but what I find interesting about it for these seminars is he makes direct comparisons between some of the philosophical ideas of truth that I've been talking about and the Dharma. So I want to talk a little bit about what he says in terms of this comparison, different approaches to truth. So on the first page of this book, he says that Buddhist thinkers make a number of tacit assumptions which are explicitly rejected by modern European philosophers. So basically saying Dharma practitioners, Buddhist thinkers, make a number of assumptions which basically European philosophers wouldn't accept. So I want to talk about those assumptions, and there's three assumptions that he talks about in particular. So the first assumption is, and Sudarshini was talking about this a little bit before the meditation we did earlier. So the first assumption is that meditation provides the main raw material for philosophical reflection. So that's sort of really interesting. So, instead of the laws of logic or external sense data, what Khonsa is saying, what we're saying as Buddhist practitioners, is actually meditation is the royal route to truth. Meditation is the main means of moving towards real reflection and moving towards truth. So that's sort of a very interesting assumption, and hopefully we sort of can taste that in our meditation, and particularly on retreat, that we can move towards truth in that way. Second assumption he talks about, which again I think I find very interesting, is he talks about the hierarchical structure of the universe. So the hierarchical structure of the universe and also of the mind. And he compares this to what, and Khonsa compares this to what he calls the democratic vogue in society and in philosophy. So basically he's saying that there's levels of truth in Buddhism. There's levels of truth in the universe of Buddhism. There's levels of truth in our minds, which we can access through meditation. And this compares to modern Western philosophical view, and more than philosophical view, view in society of like the democracy of value, if you like, or the democracy of facts, the democracy of individuals. Again, there's very good reasons why we have that fashion, if you like, or vogue of democracy of facts. You could sort of trace some of the dangers of hierarchy in society. That's a whole another talk. But what he's saying very clearly is, the Dharma talks about hierarchy, the hierarchy of the universe. In particular, it talks about three levels of reality and characterizes the mind, as having three levels. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that shortly. I will come back to that. I'll finish with that actually as well. But I just want to say the third assumption that Khonsa talks about in Buddhist thought in India is the idea of revelation or insight as the ultimate source of all truth. So insight or revelation as the source of truth and real knowledge and wisdom. So again, contrasting that with the idea that rationalism, logic, empiricism, science can provide ultimate truth. He's bringing in the faculty of intuition, faculty of imagination, and the idea of revelation or insight. So yeah, just to recap those three levels: meditation as the way that we approach truth, particularly on the basis of ethics, an ethically pure life. And then the idea of the hierarchical structure of the universe and of the mind. All of our Buddhist practice really as a preparation for insight, for entering the stream, as it's known, trying to contact real truth, trying to become real truth, as the Buddha did. Yeah, I'll say a little bit more about this idea of hierarchy, hierarchy of the universe and of the mind. Well, it's traditionally talked about as the Trikaya doctrine. So Trikaya, Kaya means body, something like body. Tri is three, as in Tri-Ratna. But you can see this doctrine as having two sides. So you've got the Trikaya doctrine on one side, and you've got the Triloka doctrine on the other side. And they're really sort of two sides of the same coin. So one is sort of more objective side of experience. So you can say the universe has got these three levels of truth. So that's the Triloka. So loka means world or place. So it's, you know, it's talked of as the three world system. That's how Konza refers to it, I think. So that's the sort of more objective side of approaching this area. And then with the Trikaya, it's the more subjective approach to the same truth. So you know, it's looking at it for more inwardly, if you like. And I've got a piece of paper with lots of explanations of this. I'm going to try and keep it as simple as possible. Let me try and talk about the three levels. So one way of talking about the first level is, so that's the Nirmanakaya, or the Karmaloka. So I'll just talk in terms of the Trikaya. So the Nirmanakaya, as it's known, basically is talked about as the world of the senses. Sangharakṣita talks about it as, I think, as the world of the lower mind. So what Konza actually is saying is the world of logic, the world of science, the world of empiricism, really is belongs to that level of our minds. So, you know, you could say somewhat provocatively that it belongs to a quite superficial part level of our minds. You know, it belongs to Nirmanakaya level of our minds. I mean, all of these distinctions are not obviously quite as rigid as I'm making out. But you know, just to sort of provocatively say that, the world of the senses, the world of science, the world of logic is relatively superficial in terms of the Buddhist conception of the mind and of the universe. The next level in this three-world system, or three-body system, if you like, is the Sambhogakaya. One way of talking about this world is, or this body, if you like, is the world of imagination, the world of myth, you could even say the world of magic. But particularly Sangharakṣita talks about, you know, the founder of our movement has got a very strong emphasis on imagination. And I talked a bit about this when I was talking about beauty. So the imagination, as being like just a crucial, maybe the crucial faculty in terms of our spiritual practice, the visionary imagination with a capital I, like a world beyond our senses, a world of pure form, is something we can contact in meditation. When we're very absorbed in meditation, we can step beyond our immediate sense experience, step beyond our logical, rational mind, and we can taste something of the imagination with capital I. This is what we're trying to do, I think, as order members, when we're trying to visualise Buddha or Bodhisattva that we're given at ordination. We're trying to sort of taste or contact this world of the imagination with a capital I, world of myth. So that's very briefly sort of characterising the second level of truth and knowledge and wisdom, if you like, from the Dharmic perspective. The third level is talked of as the Dharmakaya. I think it's also Well, no, I won't bring in yet another system. I mean, Subhuti's been talking about the Dharma Nyama as well. I think it's in the same area. So the Dharmakaya. And the best thing to do when talking about the Dharmakaya is really just to be silent, actually, because you can't really say anything about the Dharmakaya. You know, it's really beyond conceptual thought. It's beyond poetic language, even. But really, you know, we've been talking about the good, the beautiful, and the true as not being separate things, but really being one thing, if you like. The Dharmakaya is the realm of that truth, that ultimate truth, the ultimate wisdom, if you like, of the Dharma. What we say as Buddhists is we can experience these levels of consciousness. We can experience higher and higher levels of consciousness. We can inhabit these worlds more and more fully through our Dharma practice. The world of the senses, the world of logic, are very, very helpful within their sphere of application. Extremely practically helpful in many, many ways. But as Dharma practitioners, we are trying to transcend that relatively superficial mind, if you like. And we're trying to... Well, actually, I took a couple of quotes from the most recent paper from Subhuti, from Sangharakshita, and he talks about trying to contact non-egoistic volition. So we're trying to step out of our individual sense of self, and we're trying to step into something Subhuti calls the omnipresent evolutionary impulse. So that's a wonderful phrase, I think. Omnipresent evolutionary impulse. What we're trying to do with all of our Dharma practice, I think, is we're trying to go beyond a narrow view of ourselves. We're trying to go beyond our self-clinging. We're trying to move to transcend our self-clinging. We're trying to move through these levels of reality, these levels of consciousness, trying to move towards this ultimate truth that really you can't put into language, but hopefully we can get a taste of through our Dharma practice. Okay, so gallop through truth from Western logic, Western philosophical point of view, and from a Dharma point of view. I'm going to draw a line there to leave some time for questions.
Not so much a question as thinking out loud something. I understand, well, I understand till a certain level that ultimate truth goes beyond logic and is beyond logic, but that doesn't mean it goes against logic or it contradicts logic in any way, does it? I mean, I think if we were to reach ultimate truth, then we would realize that in a way it's probably quite logical, even though it's not graspable through logic.
It's very interesting, yeah.
I was thinking also when you were talking about the economic downturn something else I forgot. I was thinking that it's not that so much that we've been let down by the loss of the market. I think that the problem is the people, not the laws. I mean, if we had really followed the laws of the market, we wouldn't have been in the situation that we are now. The problem is that we're so trapped in other things like greed, for example, that we jump. I mean, we ignore logic. And the laws of the market are quite logical, I think. And what's happened is not logical. What's happened is because we've ignored those laws, and the logic of those laws, that's how it's sad. So what, you know, that's something really logical and negative has happened. So
yes, two very good questions there, I think. Yeah, I mean, maybe one way of talking about the Dharma is that it's not the Dharma is not irrational. The Dharma is very rational, but you can talk about the Dharma as being non-rational as well. I don't know much about Zen Buddhism. I've not practiced as a Zen Buddhist. I think what Zen is trying to... doesn't stop me from saying something about Zen. What Zen Buddhism is trying to get to is this non-rational conception of truth. And again, Sangharakshita talks about this, Bante talks about this. Now, some of the perfection of wisdom texts, actually all of the perfection of wisdom texts, what they do is they take the laws of logic and they set them against each other as a means of transcending those laws and transcending ourselves. And as we think about the Heart Sutra, for example, you know, these brilliant, seemingly illogical lines, you know, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. You know, the whole of that tradition of Buddhism, which ultimately sort of led to Zen Buddhism, is constantly trying to use logic to take your legs away from under you. It's saying, well, actually, the Dharma isn't, it's non-rational. It's like we're trying to get to a truth that actually can't be expressed in concepts. But obviously we need to use everything we can, you know, our rational minds to reflect on the Dharma, our imaginations. We need to use all of our faculties, you know, including our reason, to try and move towards that truth. So it's something, we need our rational faculties to approach this non-rational truth of the Dharma, I think. And I think what I was trying to say about the markets is I've been reading a bit from George Soros, who he's you know, some of you will know George Soros. He's a hedge fund manager worth billions of pounds, and when the UK joined the exchange rate mechanism in the early 90s, he pretty much single-handedly made the government come out of the exchange rate mechanism, because he was basically betting millions of pounds, billions of pounds probably, on that eventuality. This is a bit of a tangent. I'll try and come back to the question. I mean, he's really influenced by Popper, actually. He's a hedge fund manager, but he's also a philosopher, George Soros. He's quite interesting to read, and he's doing a lot of he's using his wealth in some positive ways in terms of philanthropy, putting billions of pounds into openness in politics and society. But basically what he talks about is economic fundamentalism. He says that, you know, even as someone who's made billions of pounds from the market, he says that the markets can't provide a moral compass, you know, partly because they, you know, they are fueled mainly by greed. So what he says is, you know, as you say, it's actually people, particularly governments and the state, that needs to bring an ethical dimension in. What I'm saying is that ethical dimension is a higher value from a Buddhist point of view than logic or the world of the senses, or, you know, those sorts of things. It's a higher value, and in the market, I think, in the economy, we've sort of lost sight of that. So it needs to come in from a higher sense of value, rather than from the same level. So more questions. I would appreciate actual questions rather than more philosophical views, but yeah. So.
Just saying, I agree. I've forgotten your name.
Sylvia.
Sylvia, yeah, I've forgotten your name. But I mean, I could just completely agree that it's not actually the laws of the market that's at fault. It's what we're witnessing is one colossal society's failure of the pursuit of greed, hatred and delusion to its logical conclusion. You know, that's what's actually happening at the moment. You know, in some respects, it's totally in conformity with the Dharma, I think. You know, this is what happens if you let the forces of greed, hatred and delusion
absolutely.
Go unbridled, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
But just something I was going to say very briefly, just on a just very minor technical point. You said that the Vienna Circle finished at the First World War, didn't it? And it did with the Second World War.
Ah, yes, thank you.
The period during the 30s was, in fact, their most productive period.
Thank you, yeah.
And in fact, Popper was a member of the Vienna Circle in his younger life.
Right, right.
He was a later stage member of the Circle. He was very influenced by the Vienna Circle. But when just a point that I would like to make was that when I was at university in the 70s, Popper was very much all the rage. He was like considered God, you see.
Yeah.
And I subsequently learned that outside of Britain, people don't regard Popper very highly. They do, you know, he has his followers in the States and in Australia, but certainly in the non-English speaking world, he's not regarded very highly at all. And I had a very interesting experience a couple of years ago, coming from Cambridge, where I listened to a lecture, an up-to-date lecture, public science lecture, by the astrophysics department on the latest discoveries on the cosmos. And I quizzed the guy afterwards. I went down the front and actually quizzed him. Because what it was all about was this whole concept of dark matter. And he said, how do you know this dark matter's there if you can't see it? And he said, because the equations tell us so.
Right.
And I said, where'd you get the equations from? He said, Einstein's general theory of relativity. And so what you've got is, in fact, not just non-verification, you've got non-falsifiability. Right. Because quite clearly, they found a gap, you know, the equations didn't actually match with the universe, and they said, there must be some more matter producing the gravitational field out there somewhere.
So
it's a classic case of non-falsifiability.
Yeah.
So I think that it basically puts Popper into a very difficult situation, because many, many scientific theories that we take as pretty strong evidence, like the general theory of relativity, like the laws of thermodynamics, are non-falsifiable, non-verifiable.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting, actually. Thanks for the clarification about the Vienna Circle. That's interesting. And I mean, this stable ground that we think we stand on in terms of science is not so stable, I think. It's very, very practically, there's nothing like it in terms of practical applications. But in terms of truth, and the only other thing I'll say is that, a Popper and the whole Vienna Circle and the logical positivists and all that, particularly Anglo-American philosophy. What I find interesting at the moment is continental philosophy and analytic philosophy are coming together a bit more.
Sure.
I think that's a good thing, actually, yeah. I'm going to move on to some other questions. There's a few hands in the air. So.
It seems to me there's a problem with the two worlds that you're bringing together here, in that in the first set, in inductive views, they at least hold out the possibility of proving that truth is a certain way or the reality is there or has a certain nature.
Yeah.
Even if you also extend that to theoretically saying, well, you can prove that because you can't iterate an experiment infinite times or whatever. In the Buddhist view, if you say that there's still a truth, right, if you can say that there's a word that both of these things are treating, an idea that they're both treating.
Yeah.
If in one you can prove it, and if in the other you're basically inviting people to feel it, or say, you can't even talk about that third level of Dharmakaya, was it?
Yeah.
What do you propose as a mechanism for understanding it? Because I mean, it's a problem because I don't, I'm really willing to be convinced by it, but it's still going to be an act of persuasion, and it's still, it often involves poetic language and saying things like stepping into the stream or whatever it is. I don't know how, if we're always talking and thinking, I don't know how we're supposed to go beyond concept, and if in fact you're not inviting somebody to prove it, you're inviting them to accept it or come to it themselves.
Yeah.
That seems to me the highest conceptualisation.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's interesting, I think, coming back to Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer approached similar areas, particularly after Hume. So Hume's view of causality, which we talked about over over the weeks of the seminar. Trying to find a solution to the external world, the empirical world, if you like. And what Schopenhauer said was, well, actually, we are objects ourselves, and we have a route into direct experience of reality from, if you like, from introversion or from looking within, for want of better words. So I think the ultimate truth I'm trying to sort of talk about in terms of the Dharma I can't convince you of that, actually. I think we can only use poetic language to point at something which we have to experience for ourselves, if we want to sort of want to do that. And, you know, the traditional way that we try and taste that truth is through practicing ethics, practicing meditation, and wisdom, approaching wisdom. So the idea is you practice ethics so that your mind is clear, pure enough, positive enough to, for you to really become absorbed in meditation. If you've got something that's troubling you ethically, you're not going to be able to have the sort of mind that can see the truth directly. So that's why ethics sort of comes first. And then, on the basis of meditation, you're trying to reflect on your experience of the world, your experience of yourself, the fact that actually that's not two separate things. So you're trying to see something directly. So it's not the sort of thing I can, not the sort of thing anybody can really sort of convince someone of, but, all of the things we do as Buddhists are trying to set up conditions for seeing that truth.
If in the Eastern sense that the truth is beyond thinking or the mind, then you would presumably need to get rid of any belief system to access it and any assumption.
Well, I think that's what the Buddha said. The Buddha talked about moving from wrong view, then moving to right view, so, views that are more conducive to truth, and then beyond that to no view, which again, what can we say about no view, but that is the path, the truth as a non-conceptual direct experience of reality. So again, it's a short answer, but I don't know, talking about no view, I don't know how one talks about that, really.
If you were trying to go down that route, then you'd be checking your assumptions all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need all of our faculties on the path. We need, very, very rigorous critical mind. Not a cynical mind, but very critical mind, so that we can really test these truths in our experience. We need a very, when we can have a sense of the mind as being still and positive enough, I think particularly on retreat, then what we do is we reflect on the truth of the Dharma, we reflect on what we take to be truth, and we test it. But, if we try and do that prematurely, if you like, or just using logic or a scientific method, it can only take us so far. I should look over here as well.
Okay. Why does ultimate truth leave ethics in the sense of if ultimate monolithic truth is what's left and everything that is changed is stripped away, is taken away? Ethics in themselves are changeable through different ages, different societies, even the idea of non-violence and thou shalt not kill, there are many different ways to interpret that. And we're kind of obsessed with truth in the media and the history of ideas. Mm. But all those ideas are, all those you know, precepts, ethical precepts can be questioned and ultimately are changeable.
There's often a distinction made between conventional morality and what's the opposite of conventional morality?
Natural morality,
thank you. So conventional morality, you know, is changeable, is sort of fashion, if you like. Some things are, wrong, in certain ages and other things, but in terms of natural morality, I think what the Dharma is trying to point at is natural morality. Again, I think about Subhuti's talks on this over the last two years. So Subhuti is the president of the LBC and has been giving these rambles about, particularly about the niyamas. And he talks about the karma niyama. So he talks about the niyamas as regularities in the universe, if you like. So the lower niyamas, so the utu niyama as the lower niyamas, utu niyama, bija niyama, and manu niyama. But then the karma niyama as being the realm of ethics. And yeah, he's talking about that as a natural law, if you like. So natural morality. In a way, something that's that we're stepping into, something that we can open up to, rather than something that changes according to the age we live in. It's that sort of natural morality that we're trying to connect with, I guess. And then Dharma Niyama as the process by which Buddhas arise, according to Subhuti. Yeah, which is, again, very suggestive and interesting, I think.
It's kind of clarified. I guess those points about the Buddhist thought in India just brought it home that either you accept that you're going to find the truth by looking inside, or you don't. I guess if you don't, you're going to be a philosopher or a scientist, possibly. And if you do, then you're going to be something else. I think it sounds like those two never kind of converge, that you have to make that kind of choice or come to that awareness or whatever.
I've been simplistic about drawing those lines and probably overstated it, because I think the great scientific geniuses or the great artistic geniuses are touching on something dharmic, I think. We have a common sense view of what science is, but if you, read about how Einstein moved towards his theories, then really it was the imagination, I think, that helped him get there. Imagination with a capital I. What I find interesting about this whole area of Western philosophy and the Dharma is actually that they do, as Sudarshini was saying in the first half, some philosophers, through using reason and very strong logical analysis, have moved to the truth of the Dharma. So I think that they can move in the same direction or towards the same thing.
Sorry, I've just got a related point on that, actually, again with regard to the two assumptions that you talked about. I know that was written in the 60s, so it's slightly different now, but recently, anyway, within psychology at least, there's a massive movement to consider meditation as a method of psychological inquiry over and above health intervention, which is obviously very popular within psychological arenas at the moment.
Yeah.
But I think that's quite a long-standing tradition. But it's just not been made so explicit. I mean, if you look back to William James, early 1900s, looking at introspection and talking about the stream of consciousness, I think you can make a lot of comparisons between using mindfulness or meditation to gain insight as a way of understanding the mind. So I think that it does cross over, definitely with psychological science, maybe not with physical science. I don't know about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. We just have to get more Western philosophers meditating. And okay, so let's leave it there. Just say thanks very much for coming along to the seminars.